Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we hear about a pioneering woman in Hollywood whose work has influenced nearly all makeup and special effects designers since. And while her creation is known to nearly all film buffs, her name is known only to few insiders in the makeup special effects business. Author Mallory O'Meara says Millicent Patrick should be a recognizable name and role model for several generations of women with filmmaking dreams. As the only woman to design a classic Hollywood film monster, the creature from the Black Lagoon, and as one of the first female animators at Disney, she should have been a trailblazer. Instead, her story was lost, she was denied credit for her groundbreaking work, and even her life has become a mystery. And that was a mystery that Mallory O'Meara decided to solve. O'Meara is an author, screenwriter, and genre film producer, and co-host of the podcast Reading Glasses. She tracked down Millicent Patrick's life and in the course of her work found that Patrick didn't live one remarkable life, but several. The Lady from the Black Lagoon, Hollywood Monsters and the Lost Legacy of Millicent Patrick is her book, which blends history, biography, and memoir with stories from Patrick's life and the author's own life, which reminds us that gender bias goes back a long way in Hollywood and still continues today. Mallory O'Meara is my guest today. Mallory O'Meara, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So what led you to undertake this story to find out about Millicent Patrick? It sounds like you are a monster film devotee. Was that the beginning?
Yes, and she started becoming my hero when I was a teenager and I first found out about her after I watched Creature from the Black Lagoon. But as I became a filmmaker myself, I really truly wanted to know more about her story. I wanted to know where she came from. I wanted to know what happened to her.
Now, you said after you first saw Creature from the Black Lagoon, she didn't get really a credit for that, did she?
Yeah, what happened was, so she designed Creature from the Black Lagoon, and she got so much press and attention for that, that her boss at the Universal Monster Shop, a man named Bud Westmore, was very, very jealous of her and ended up firing her and took her credit. And so she was purposely obfuscated, and no one really knew what happened to her for decades and decades.
So how did you find out that she actually designed? How did you first find out that she designed that creature?
Well, unfortunately, Bud Westmore, or I guess I should say fortunately, he is no match for the internet. So when the movie nerds sort of took to the internet and started, you know, she ended up dying in 1998, which was the year that IMDb got superpowered by Amazon.com. And thanks to the internet, you know, fans of films were able to start sharing private collections and pictures and articles and things that had been buried for a very, very long time. And images of her working on the creature suit started circulating on the internet. And so devoted monster nerds like myself, who were really deeply looking into Creature from the Black Lagoon, were able to find those photos.
And really, she had an amazing career, even though it was totally in the shadows for the most part. Bit parts as an extra or maybe a line or two in films, actually as an actress, but as an animator and a designer.
Yeah, I sort of have been referring to Millicent Patrick as the Forrest Gump of the 1950s because she had such a cinematic life. You know, she grew up on the estate of Hearst Castle and interacted a lot with William Randolph Hearst and some of the big personalities there. And then right out of college, her very first job was working at Walt Disney Studios, and she worked there for a couple of years and ended up animating some really, really great films, including Dumbo. She became a model, a background actress, a designer, a book illustrator, and she ended up also what we would call now becoming a concept artist for Universal Studios.
A what exactly?
A concept artist.
Concept artist.
That's what we would call it now.
Uh-huh. And so she would sort of sketch out the initial designs for something, and then other designers would take it and bring it into reality?
Yeah. So she would design makeup, you know, beauty makeups, but also monster makeups. She would design monster suits, and she would sketch out on her sketch pad ideas for those things, and then the best design would be chosen by the producers of the project and her boss at the Universal Monster Shop, Bud Westmore, as I previously mentioned, and then a sculptor would take those designs and make them into something real.
So this book, The Lady from the Black Lagoon, it's almost like a detective story, the way you write it. And it's two stories in one. It's a detective story about actually trying to unearth information about Millicent Patrick, because for one thing, Millicent Patrick was a pseudonym that she came up with, what was it, in the late 1940s? She was actually had a different name as she was working at Disney and in her early life.
Yeah, Millicent Patrick ended up working under seven different names over the course of her life. So she truly sort of became a researcher's nightmare. And the process of finding her and sort of reverse engineering her life and going after these little breadcrumbs that were scattered under all these different identities that she had became such an interesting story in itself that I decided to include it in the book and really show people, you know, Bud Westmore didn't just fire her when he told her she wasn't working at Universal anymore. I really wanted to show people the devastating effect that that had on her entire career and on the careers of women who might have wanted to follow in her path but couldn't because there was nothing about her anywhere.
So where did you begin? What did you know about her as you began this search?
The first thing I knew for certain was that she worked on Creature from the Black Lagoon. So that's where I started. And I reached out to film historians and monster nerd friends of mine. I got a library card, and I just worked from there. Putting together Millicent Patrick's life was sort of like making a puzzle. You know, I put the corner pieces down and started working on the edges and then filled it in from there, just from every little piece that I would find. And it, you know, I could work backwards or forwards depending on what chunk of her life I was working on. And it took me about 3 years in total to get everything.
Yeah. I was struck at the beginning of the book. She said, you know, you sort of relate the story of how she was a researcher's nightmare. In fact, there was actually a mistake in her birth certificate. I mean, that's just sort of the first step of trying to find some of these seven names she worked under.
Oh, yeah, that was, I couldn't, for almost a year, I couldn't figure out where her birth certificate was. But it turned out that one of her middle names was misspelled, so it wouldn't come up correctly in search engines. And it took many different archive searches before I finally found it.
Yeah. Earlier, you mentioned her association with the Hearst Castle. She actually grew up, a good part of her life was growing up at the Hearst Castle. Not as like a guest, but her father was an engineer and perhaps an architectural structural engineer.
Yeah, her father was a man named Camille Rossi, and he was the superintendent of construction at Hearst Castle for 10 years. And Hearst Castle was such a remote location for this very, very extravagant estate that William Randolph Hearst essentially had to create a town just to support the house. You know, it wasn't just a beautiful summer home he had to build. He had to build country roads and a wharf and a whole infrastructure to support his staff. And so that's where Millicent Patrick lived, in this little estate village called San Simeon. And she grew up hanging around Hearst Castle. And she didn't live in the castle itself. And that's a very, very important distinction, because she ended up spending her entire life trying to get back to that sort of glamour. I mean, after you grow up hanging around William Randolph Hearst, where else can you go besides Hollywood?
Yeah. And that beginning of the story tells another larger story that's a part of The Lady from the Black Lagoon, because it's a bigger story than the mystery of the woman that created an iconic Hollywood legend. It's about sexism then and now. You write of your own experiences as a producer in Hollywood. You also write of her father's own sort of sexism, because he's working for a legendary female architect that actually worked with Hearst. And what you found was Camille basically was undermining, I believe it was Julia Morgan, the architect, fairly regularly, is what you found in the course of your research.
Yeah, it's a really interesting story, because when you read the book, it gives you sort of an eagle-eyed view onto how these things perpetuate themselves. And so Camille Rossi wasn't the boss at the on Hearst Castle construction. He was the engineer. The true boss on that project was a woman named Julia Morgan. She was a very, very important architect. She designed almost 800 buildings in California over the course of her life. She's a very, very famous, very influential woman. And Camille Rossi did not like having to answer to her. And he was constantly undermining her, so much so that there was one project where she put up a sign in front of the pool that said, Camille Rossi, you cannot enter this under any circumstances. She got so fed up with him. But through reading this, you can see how that gave Millicent Patrick sort of the blueprint on how things were dealt with and how things were. And by looking at, you know, an entire life like that and all the influences, you see why what happened with her and Bud Westmore happened and why she didn't fight back.
Yeah, it was interesting because she put up with him for over 10 years, you know, and it would be like she would make one decision and he would say, well, no, that's not going to work, so we should do it this way. I mean, it was literally that much sort of undermining going on.
Yeah, one of his favorite things to do was if he had a great idea, he wouldn't tell his boss, Julia Morgan. He would go around her and tell it to William Randolph Hearst himself to try to curry some favor. But what he was really doing was just making Julia Morgan mad. And this was back in the 20s. You know, there was no Twitter. There was no way to call people out like there is now. So Julia Morgan just sort of dealt with it. And while she was dealing with all this undermining, Camille Rossi was telling his family, oh, you know, this Julia Morgan, she's so frustrating. She's making things difficult. So Millicent Patrick didn't even realize over the entire course of her life that the reason why they left Hearst Castle when they did wasn't because William Randolph Hearst ran out of money or anything. It was because he got fired because of what he was doing to Julia Morgan.
Hmm. Now, this was one of your first clues into her life, was the fact that, I guess, at Hearst Castle, you finally actually saw her, a video, I guess, or was it a video or tape recording of her telling the story for the history of Hearst Castle? They were interviewing families of the workpeople that lived at Hearst Castle.
Yes, one of my first big breaks was in the Los Angeles Times archives, I actually found an interview and an article about Millicent Patrick from 1985, where she was talking about her father's work at Hearst Castle. And it was such a big clue because it wasn't under Millicent Patrick. It was under Millicent Patrick Trent, which was the name that she went under after her work at Universal. So that not only gave me a clue as to what happened to Millicent Patrick after her work on Creature from the Black Lagoon, but it also gave me my clue as to what happened to her when she was a child and where she grew up. And I went to Hearst Castle myself, which is a really beautiful place. It's an incredible place to visit if you're ever in Southern California. But they actually had an audio recording that was about 30 minutes long of Millicent Patrick herself telling her own story of growing up there. And it was the first time I got to hear her voice in a conversation. It was amazing to be able to get such a primary source and hear her describing her own childhood.
And this is one of the things you did in the way you wrote the book. It's partially your own memoir, but it's also, you really tell the detective story of how you researched this story. Why did you decide to use that approach?
Well, one, it was just so interesting. A lot of people don't realize how difficult it was to find her. She lived in an age before the internet, before Facebook. When I started working on this project, she didn't even have a Wikipedia page. But I wanted to show the devastating effects that sexism can have, because the parts of Millicent Patrick's life have been lying around in archives for 65 years. But because she was a woman, and because a lot of people didn't believe that she could do the things that she did because she was a woman, she was dismissed and these pieces of her life were ignored. So I wanted to take the reader on that journey with me to show, you know, Millicent was dealing with sexism while she was alive, but she also had to deal with it while she was dead. And that's part of the reason why her legacy hasn't been told until now.
Right. She was obviously a very striking woman and a very talented artist. You have a number of her illustrations and some of her drawings in the book. She was very talented.
Oh, she was extremely talented. And that was sort of the frustrating thing for her and for me writing about her, is that she was so striking and she was so beautiful that that's really what got people's attention. And it sort of took away the spotlight from her own work and her own talents. And then after she passed away, people, you know, didn't believe that this beautiful woman could make monsters because it was so anomalous for them.
You mentioned that she got a job at Disney, and she got a job at Disney at a really amazing point. I believe it was right around 1938, 1939, as Disney is becoming Disney. She worked on Fantasia.
Yeah.
She was part of the team that created an amazing monster in Fantasia, in the A Night on Bald mountain, the monster that comes alive at the end of that segment.
Yeah, that was one of my most favorite parts of researching this book, because Chernabog, who is the demon in the Night on Bald Mountain sequence, which is my favorite part of Fantasia, he's my favorite animated monster. He was my first favorite horror film. I fell in love with him when I was really, really young. I just love his design so much. And when I found out that Millicent worked on not only one of my favorite live-action monsters in Creature from the Black Lagoon, but also on Chernabog in Fantasia, I just realized that, gosh, she's just the queen of monsters.
She worked at Disney for a few years, but she left. Was it she was just laid off because of the war, because of cutbacks in the animation department, or was there something more afoot there?
There were a few things. It was a really difficult time to be working at Disney. This was during the right after the union strikes in 1941. The war was going on. But Millicent's biggest problem was that she was plagued by migraines, and looking into a light box, which is literally a lighted box that animators have to use, was very physically taxing for her. And it just became too much, so she ended up leaving. And she continued to be an artist. She did a lot of illustration work and fashion design after that, but she never animated ever again.
My guest today is Mallory O'Meara. She's an author, screenwriter, and producer. She co-hosts the literary podcast Reading Glasses, and she's the author of The Lady from the Black Lagoon, Hollywood Monsters and the Lost Legacy of Millicent Patrick, the woman who designed the creature from the Black Lagoon. You know, this is an iconic monster and has had an impact even in Oscar-winning films as recent as just a couple of years ago, The Shape of Water. Just an amazing, amazing woman that you really had to suss out her career. From the time she left Disney till the time she moved to Universal and worked with Bud Westmore, which we'll get into in just a moment, these were sort of lost years, weren't they? They were the ones that were really difficult to come up with, and you finally found the information, and you found really a series of relationships that really ended badly and were kind of tragic.
Yes, Millicent's relationships were just as cinematic and over the top as her career was. One of the things that I found that led me to those in-between years was that Millicent Patrick dated the man who we know, if you've ever seen an animated clip called Red Hot Riding Hood, which is sort of a burlesque parody of Little Red Riding Hood and the Big Bad Wolf, the man who voiced that wolf, Millicent Patrick had a relationship with, and he actually committed suicide in 1950 in Santa Monica, holding a picture of Millicent Patrick because she had broken up with him.
Wow. And this is what people will remember, is the iconic image of the wolf with his eyes sort of going out of his head like telescopes, right? And going back into his
yes.
head. Yeah, no,
yes, that's the man.
Yeah. And I guess she had another relationship, and this is how she came up with the Patrick name, because she was, I guess, Mildred Rossi up to this point?
Yes. Mildred Rossi is her birth name, and she animated under that name at Disney, and she ended up, after she left Disney, marrying a man named Paul Fitzpatrick, who was also an animator at Disney, and both of them left at Disney at the same time, and that was another very tumultuous relationship, because that man was already married when Millicent and him struck up a relationship, and it was a very tumultuous, tragic affair, and it didn't end up lasting, but after they got divorced, she went from Mildred Fitzpatrick to Mill Patrick, and then she sort of, that's what kicked off Millicent Patrick, because she fell in love with the name.
But in the early 50s, she came into Universal, and she began working for Bud Westmore, and you tell the story of the Westmore. The Westmore name was, I mean, their father had been sort of the pioneering makeup person in Hollywood, and the sons literally ran makeup in Hollywood. I mean, all of them had a hand in most of the major studios of that time, right?
Yes. Bud Westmore's father was a man named George Westmore, and he quite literally invented the idea of a makeup department on a studio set. Up until that point, all the actors would do their own makeups, which would lead to some continuity errors in between scenes. But George Westmore said, hey, we should have somebody on set to, you know, manage this stuff to make sure everything looks the same from shot to shot. And he had five sons, and all of them went into makeup. And there was a period of time where every single son was running a makeup department at a major Hollywood studio, whether it be Warner Brothers or Paramount or Universal or the now-defunct studio Eagle Lion, I mean, this was a makeup dynasty.
And when she came to work for Bud Westmore at Universal, this seemed like a perfect job for him because he was makeup and he was really more administrative than actually a hands-on guy, and she was a very creative person.
Yes, so the Universal Monster Shop was so big that Bud Westmore really didn't have the time to do as much creative work, just like anyone who's running a big department. And Bud Westmore was really known for his beauty makeup. That's what the Westmore family was known for. And Bud Westmore took over from a man that listeners might know named Jack Pierce. And Jack Pierce is truly the king of monster makeup in Hollywood. Even now, he's sort of unbested. He's the one who came up with the designs for The Mummy, for Boris Karloff's Frankenstein, for The Wolfman. And Bud Westmore didn't really do monster stuff. That wasn't his thing. So when Universal in the 50s decided they wanted to get into science fiction movies and get back to making monster films, he needed someone on hand to help him make those designs, and that ended up being Millicent Patrick.
And she came up with a doozy, right, in the case of the creature?
Yes. The creature from the Black Lagoon is still one of the most iconic monster designs, even though he is the only classic Universal monster franchise to have never been remade or rebooted. It's never been redone, despite all the different Dracula and Frankenstein and Wolfman movies we have. There's only one creature. And he's still so iconic. People who have never even seen the movie know will be able to recognize, oh, that's Creature from the Black Lagoon. And Guillermo del Toro's 2017 Oscar-winning film, The Shape of Water, wouldn't exist without both that film and Millicent Patrick's incredible design.
Yeah. And I think the people at Universal realized how important that was at the time, didn't they?
Yes. During test screenings, when the audience just fell in love with the monster, they very quickly started to realize that they had a very, very special movie on their hands.
And in that, this sowed the seeds of Millicent Patrick's disappearance from Hollywood makeup.
Yes. So it was sort of tragic because it ended up being the thing that was the pinnacle of her career, but it also became her downfall because when they were shooting the movie, Bud Westmore didn't even really like the creature from the Black Lagoon. He thought the monster was too empathetic. He didn't think that they should shoot the monster in daylight like they did, and he was already starting to badmouth the movie. But then once the test audiences were really, truly falling in love with him, Bud Westmore changed his tune, and then Universal, as they were coming up with ways to promote the movie, they said, wow, you know, we have this really striking, beautiful woman who designed Creature. Why don't we send her out on a press tour to promote it, and it'll be the beauty who created the beast. But Bud Westmore wasn't having that, and that was the big problem, is that nowadays, you know, when we go to watch a film, there's a 10-minute end crawl at the end, and we see every single person who was involved in it. But back in the 1950s, only the heads of production got credit on screen for the work. So Bud Westmore was getting credit for the entire makeup team. It just said Bud Westmore. And this was going to be the very first time in history that somebody other than the department head was going to get credit for something. So he was very unhappy about it and made a big stink. And he told the Universal publicity department, you can't do this. So they said, all right, well, we'll change it up. Well, it'll be the beauty who lives with the beast. And we'll say that Millicent didn't design it, but we'll still send her out on tour to promote the movie because she's so beautiful. And she agreed, and she went out on to do this tour and lied and said that Bud Westmore did the design.
And that didn't save her job, did it?
It didn't, and that was the truly heartbreaking part, is that so they sent her out on tour, and she was on television and on the radio, newspapers and magazines, and traveling around the country. And even though she stuck to her script and said, yep, Bud Westmore designed Creature, he was so jealous of all the attention that she was receiving that he fired her while she was away. And they pulled her off of the several movies that she was already starting to make designs for. And when she got back to Los Angeles, she didn't have a job and she faded into obscurity. And Bud Westmore went on to claim credit for the creature and for the next few decades.
And it sounds like it was more than just firing her. He almost put a blacklist in place. We have to remember that was the time of the actual Hollywood blacklist. And he sort of did it in his own way for this technical job.
Yeah, that's what people need to remember, is that once you were out with the Westmores, I mean, they really were such a makeup dynasty that if you weren't approved of by the Westmores, Millicent wasn't going to be getting any makeup designing jobs at any other studios.
You know, it's interesting, since you've run into this story and publicized this story, as you've written the book, you've run into still a bit of pushback as you've tried to tell Patrick's story for men who don't believe that she could have designed the creature. How surprising is that?
I mean, as a filmmaker, as a woman who works in the same industry that she did, I'm not surprised. I do deal with this in my own way every day. I deal with a lot of sexism. Every woman I know who works in the industry deals with a lot of it. But even before I started writing the book, while I was just researching it, I had a lot of male historians who said, you know, I don't believe Millicent Patrick did this work. I think it was all a stunt. I think that she was just somebody's girlfriend. And now while I'm on book tour, you know, I had a major horror convention turn me down for an appearance because they didn't want to sully the reputation of Bud Westmore.
Really? Oh, so this is still controversial within a lot of circles then.
Yes, even though there is incontrovertible proof that Millicent Patrick designed Creature from the Black Lagoon, there's still people who are not happy about women in horror.
What is the proof in your mind?
There's photos of her working on the suit herself,
right. Mm-hmm.
Not publicity photos. There's
right.
just photos of her on set working on them. But also the man who sculpted the suit, Chris Mueller, said, oh, Millicent Patrick designed the creature. I sculpted the creature from her designs. And I don't know how much more proof people need besides that.
Absolutely. And of course, this is the other side of the story that you tell in The Lady from the Black Lagoon. My guest today is Mallory O'Meara. She's the author of The Lady from the Black Lagoon, Hollywood Monsters and the Lost Legacy of Millicent Patrick. And you tell your own stories of sexism, because this is not something from the 40s or the 50s or even the 20s when you're talking about her father. This is something that still happens in Hollywood to this very day.
Yes, and the best way I knew how to illustrate that was to put my own stories in, to say, look, it's so easy to look back and say, oh, you know, that's just how things were in the 1950s, but it's not. It's still how they are now. And to illustrate that, I said, hey, look, here's something that happened to me a year ago. Here's something that happened to me 6 months ago. This is still such an active issue that women face, and here are examples of it.
Now, let me ask you about the creative community that is making monster films today, like the creative team that helped create The Shape of Water's monster, or contemporary. Do they understand the influence of Millicent Patrick on the creature and on their work?
Oh, for sure. One of the great things I got is that the creature designer for The Shape of Water, who is a very, very talented artist named Mike Hill, he gave me a great quote for this book that's included at the end, where he talks about her design and how, you know, The Shape of Water wouldn't exist without her.
Well, the name of the book is The Lady from the Black Lagoon. Mallory, thanks very much for joining us. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Mallory O'Meara is an author, screenwriter, and film producer and co-host of the literary podcast Reading Glasses. Her book about the designer of the classic film monster, The Creature from the Black Lagoon, is titled The Lady from the Black Lagoon, Hollywood Monsters and the Lost Legacy of Millicent Patrick. It's published by Hanover Square Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.